Hello, and welcome to Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of a pretty busy week in business and finance, given that it was Thanksgiving week. Of course, I, Felix Salmon of Axios, and Elizabeth Spires.
Hello.
And Emily Peck.
Hello, hello.
We are all going to talk about OpenAI and what went on there, because that was the big crazy, and you've never seen anything like it. So that is coming up. We are also going to talk about Binance, though, because there was a major prosecution agreement with Binance, the biggest crypto exchange in the world. We're going to talk about Javier Milei, who got elected as the next president of Argentina. We have a Slate Plus segment on Larry Summers. It's a good one this week. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, so normally Thanksgiving is a quiet week where nothing much happens and we can all just snooze and eat lots of turkey. This year, this turns out to have been one of those weeks where we really need a Slate Money. So Emily, can you just give me the big top level overview, first of all, of what the hell happened to OpenAI?
Basically, about a little over a week ago, Sam Altman, the very famous CEO of OpenAI, which is the company that everyone knows about because they're the ones who put out ChatGPT about a year ago, and that went crazy. And it basically broke AI into the mainstream and made AI this force in our minds, in the economy, all of that. He was fired abruptly, all of a sudden, no warning, no indication, no news stories. It was totally out of the blue, which really almost never happens in like CEO world. It's pretty rare. And it happened like, I think it happened on a Friday, and people were freaking out because this is a guy, a CEO at the height of his powers, at a company kind of at the height of its powers. And we'll get into why the company is really weird. But yeah, he was fired out of nowhere. Is total surprise. Microsoft, which has invested, I think it holds like 49% of OpenAI, they come out and they say, we didn't even know this was happening until a minute before it happened. And the whole world freaks out, especially because it's the week leading into Thanksgiving. There's no other business news. So this is the business news to end all business news. So that happens. And it's crazy. Then a few days later, Sam Altman or someone else, there's reporting, he's going to come back. He's not going to come back. Then the company appoints a CEO, interim CEO. She stops being interim CEO in less than 24 hours. They put in another interim CEO, this guy from Twitch. Crazy. There's like profiles, and the news frenzy is reaching fevered dimensions. There's no other business news to cover. There's like 60 explainers about the new CEO, okay? Everyone's all about the new CEO. There's profiles why you need to be afraid of the new CEO, why it's good that the new CEO is there. Then, not many days later, new CEO is out. Sam Altman, reinstated triumphantly, comes back to the company. All of this, I believe, in less than a week time, it happens. So now Sam Altman is back at the company. You could say nothing has changed, but everything has changed, and we will discuss.
Everything has changed in some pretty profound ways, but most importantly, basically the board that fired him is gone. And this is, from a governance perspective, absolutely fascinating to me. Effectively, what happened was that the employees of OpenAI fired the board. The board was a non-profit board. It had no fiduciary obligation to shareholders. They actually have a charter saying our only fiduciary obligation is to humanity as a whole. And so you know, when you're accountable only to humanity as a whole, that basically makes you unaccountable. But it turns out that they are actually answerable to employees. Employees turned out to have the real power here. And when the overwhelming majority of employees, I think ultimately more than 700 of the 750-odd employees, signed a letter basically saying, we're going to quit unless Sam Altman is reinstated in the board resigns. When you saw that level of worker power basically unite behind the ousted CEO, they wound up trouncing the power of the board and indeed the power of Microsoft, which had briefly managed to hire Sam Altman along the way. He was like a Microsoft employee at some point. And then he's like, oh, actually, never mind. I'm not going to go work for Microsoft after all. I'm going to go back to my old job running OpenAI. I'm so happy that you're here, Emily. I wanted to ask you, what does this tell you about the power of workers? And there's been a lot of takes about how this shows the power of capitalism over the, you know, nonprofit mandates that various people like OpenAI have. But in terms of just like labor versus capital, how do you see this whole saga?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I did forget to mention in my sweeping overview that almost all of OpenAI's employees, you know, signed this letter and threatened to quit. I don't know if this is something that could be replicated to other companies, you know, an employee kind of revolt, an insistence that the board or the CEO act in a certain way. I think it's a very unique situation to AI, because right now, anyone with AI experience or knowledge, these are basically like the hottest guys at the party. Like, these employees are the most sought after employees in tech. There's this AI wage premium that I've written about and tons of other people have written about. Like, everyone wants to hire these guys. Like, when the company and the CEO, it was unclear what was going to happen. I think Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, you know, he tweeted, we will hire any of you. We'll match your salary. These are the hottest of the hot.
These workers can work anywhere they want.
Exactly. And they do have a lot of power, but I don't think you could say that all workers have that kind of power, right, Elizabeth?
Yeah, it's also an unusual situation for a couple of reasons. You know, Microsoft is an investor in OpenAI's for-profit subsidiary, but it operates on a capped return model, so you can't get, you know, ridiculous valuations for the company.
You can. The cap is 100x. So like let's not get ourselves that the cap is important.
Well, I mean, when you look at early stage venture and what they expect, and, you know, especially for a company like OpenAI that's been talked about as a potential unicorn, I think that's material. But the other thing is, Microsoft has a heavy incentive to keep OpenAI together because they are invested. So when Altman was initially going to Microsoft and there were talks about him coming back, the CEO of Microsoft, you know, intervened and tried to facilitate that happening, which I can't think of any other situation like that where the person hiring Altman would have an incentive to help him go back to the prior company.
Yeah, I think Microsoft was happy either way. You know, Microsoft didn't invest in OpenAI in order to make lots of money by exiting at some point in the future, right? Microsoft invested in OpenAI because it wanted to become a leader in AI, and you can see that in its share price, that, you know, it seems to have overtaken a lot of its rivals in terms of at least how the stock market values its AI and expertise, much of which is OpenAI sort of by proxy, that because Microsoft has that investment in OpenAI, its rivals can't. It's kind of like blocked them out that way. It would have also been perfectly happy for Sam Altman to bring all of its employees over to Microsoft, which was like the plan for 5 minutes in the middle there. Like, that would also have been fine. You know, if the Microsoft investment in OpenAI went to zero, they hadn't actually invested very much money in OpenAI. They, you know, there's been big headlines about $10 billion or $13 billion or something that they invested in OpenAI, but very little of that was actual cash. And most of the cash they did invest was in the future. And most of what they did invest was just like credits for compute, for Azure compute. And so like, if they wound up getting all of the talent and all of the real value in the company, which is the employees, just coming to work for Microsoft. That would have been fine. But they're also happy with them at arm's length doing what they have been doing up until now, partly because this is a really gnarly, dangerous, weird part of the world. One of the reasons why OpenAI was set up as a nonprofit is because people realized how gnarly and weird and dangerous it was, and they felt, Sam Altman and Elon Musk and the other co-founders felt, that it did need a layer of like people who weren't just trying to make money at the top controlling things. You know, quite famously, Google with its DeepMind subsidiary kind of got to the large language model technology a couple of years before OpenAI did. They just never released it as a product because they were very scared about the consequences of doing so. And, you know, there has always been this tension within OpenAI, going back a few years to when a bunch of the more ideological employees left to form Anthropic, that those employees like saw the way that Sam Altman had turned it into a for-profit effectively, and saw the way he was monetizing it and productizing it, and got very scared about that. And while Microsoft can sort of happily accept that at an arm's length partner, it would have been maybe a bit harder for them to have to deal with it internally and have to run everything by their compliance officers and that kind of thing. So I think Satya Nadella at Microsoft is very happy with this outcome.
Yeah, I think also, you know, to your point, one of the reasons why the board was spooked initially is that, you know, the board skewed toward not AI doomerism, but more of a safety orientation. And supposedly there was some big internal development where OpenAI has been working on a more advanced model that's supposedly getting close to artificial general intelligence, which is not really a thing. It doesn't exist right now. Ridiculously, they've named it QStar, which I feel like is going to make the QAnon people lose their minds. But we still don't know what QStar really is.
The QStar thing is, I feel like this is a sideshow. There's no actual evidence that the board received any letters about QStar or that they acted on because of QStar. Certainly, for the time being, the actual reasons why the board's fired Altman are very, very opaque, and they don't seem to have really told anyone, and they don't seem to be capable of writing it down anywhere. And it's all kind of moot at this point anyway, because they've all been fired, or all but one of them have been fired, and they've been replaced by Larry Summers. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong?
You need somebody on the board to be wrong at all times, and that was the ideal candidate.
So it seems like, based on all the reporting, that their beef generally was they were afraid of over-commercializing AI, and they were idealistic in their beliefs and all this. But they really cocked it up.
Well, we don't know that. We have no idea. The only thing they said was that he basically wasn't being fully candid, which may or may not have been related to this like side project he had where he was running around Saudi Arabia trying to raise billions of dollars to create a new chip maker to compete with NVIDIA, which is kind of a weird thing to do when you have a full-time job running OpenAI. And maybe he wasn't being open about that. Maybe there was other talk about, maybe it was a couple of announcements at the developer day when they said they were going to open things up more, like, and probably the board hadn't been totally read into what they were going to announce at the developer day. No one really knows. There could be a million different things going on there. We do seem to know that the board acted in a very rushed way, didn't seem to run anything by any lawyers, didn't seem to think it through very well, didn't give anyone any advance notice, and just generally weren't capable of explaining themselves in a sort of coherent way to anyone at all. And ultimately, they were there to have the sort of high-minded ideals and stick to the Polestar kind of mission of the company. But because they couldn't articulate that in any way, they lost everyone's support.
That is what's so interesting to me. It's this idealism meets the real world dynamic that is so sort of troubling, affirming to anyone who cares about sort of money and business and reality, because it so shows you that these people meant to protect humanity with all these very lofty ideals don't have or didn't have the capability to put them into practice. And you see it, you see those kinds of things, you know, all over. You see it in politics all the time. People have very lofty ideals about, you know, the way the world should work. And then they take over, you know, Congress and shut the government down. And they don't know what to do about it. It's just the same kind of thing where idealism meets reality and, you know, reality has to prevail.
We should mention as well that this particular flavor of idealism is very, very close to, almost identical to, Sam Bankman-Fried's flavor of idealism, which is the long-termist sub-flavor of effective altruism. And this whole fustercluck has basically just, you know, when EA was already down and suffering in the wake of the FTX implosion, has now just provided yet another sort of death blow to it. It does. I think you're absolutely right, Emily, that this is proof that when Silicon Valley gets idealistic, like, it just doesn't work in practice.
But also depends on the ideals. You know, the tension in this story is between the decelerationists and the people who are accelerationists, and Altman's kind of the latter. I think most of the staff at OpenAI skew toward accelerationism. Mm.
You see, I'm not sure about that, Elizabeth. I really don't think that's true. Remember that Altman set this up as a nonprofit because on some level he is a decelerationist. He portrayed the move to a for-profit as kind of a necessary evil in order to raise the amount of money needed to get the compute needed to fulfill the mission. But he's the founder of OpenAI. He, you know, he had no stock in OpenAI, famously, right? He sent out this tweet saying, like, if the board doesn't like what I'm doing, they can come at me for the full value of my shares, which is ha-ha, funny tweet, because the full value of his shares was zero, right? He sat on the board with no equity in OpenAI precisely because he felt that no board members should be financially invested in this. He didn't, like, I think painting him as an accelerationist in the vein of someone like Marc Andreessen is a little bit wrong. I think he's not quite there, but he is in the camp of releasing products, of monetizing. I guess, like, on some level, he's just a capitalist. He came from Y Combinator, which is a very capitalist organization in Silicon Valley that made him a lot of money. So he's independently wealthy anyway. He doesn't need the money. He drives around in a $20 million McLaren.
Wait, that's how much that car costs? $20 million?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how much that car costs.
Oh, my God. How can a smart person drive around in a $20 million car? That honestly seems stupid to me. Sorry, don't mean to do the tangent here, but
it's true. Like, he's not one of those people like Sam Bankman-Fried who's like, I'm going to make the world better by making lots of money and giving the money away, right?
And driving a Corolla.
And also, that's the big difference between the nonprofit OpenAI owning the for-profit OpenAI versus something like a nonprofit Patagonia owning the for-profit Patagonia, or a nonprofit Bloomberg owning the for-profit Bloomberg, or a nonprofit Novo Nordisk Foundation owning the for-profit Novo Nordisk. Right? With all of those, all the nonprofit really wants is the money from the profits from the for-profit to go ahead and then just use those profits and give them away in a way that benefits humanity. In OpenAI, there are no profits of the for-profit subsidiary. It's a money losing operation, not a money making operation. And the purpose of the nonprofit is not to spend profits from the subsidiary, but rather to just use the subsidiary to develop AGI in a moral way. And so it's a very complex and troubled kind of setup. I think people were far too facile about whether it would work. And ultimately, although the nonprofit mission certainly helped in terms of getting OpenAI to attract the talent, like, talent in AI really likes talking about this kind of thing. When push comes to shove, the talent, the labor, the workers saw the amount of money that their equity was worth, saw that Sam Altman was offering them liquidity at an $86 billion valuation, saw that that offer was about to, like, completely evaporate. And they were like, fuck it. We've already mentally cashed that check and we don't want to lose it. And I think, you know, coming back to my original question to Emily in terms of labor versus capital, I think this was just capital. Like, all of these workers were shareholders. And really, it was the shareholder workers who wanted to protect the value of their $86 billion investment much more than anything else that caused the arrival of capitalist Larry Summers on the board.
Yeah, that, I feel like that's a very cynical way of looking at the workers who signed that letter. And I didn't see enough great reporting that came out and said these people were really worried about, you know, getting paid out on the shares that they had in OpenAI. These workers are already really well paid, making, I think in some cases, over $300,000 a year.
No, that, way over 300. The average salary is north of 800,000, and some of them are on like tens of millions. Yeah. Uh-huh. In the original press release, they appointed the CTO as the new CEO, and they said that the former chairman would no longer serve on the board, but would continue to work for the company. And within about 6 minutes, the chairman said, wait, what? No, you fired me from the board. I'm quitting the company. And the CTO said, wait, I don't want to be the CEO. I want Sam back as the CEO. if you announce a major transition of a new CEO and like major and founders being kicked off the board, you want to do that in a planned out way so that the new, you know, ex post status quo is stable enough to last more than 7 minutes, you know? And they were so incompetent, they couldn't even manage that.
It's very much, if you come at the king, you best not miss kind of situation. And it's very Succession in its ham-handedness. Like, it just was not executed. I mean, come on. Even I know, like, you got to prep the ground before you make the move.
The three of us could have done this better.
Yeah, they did a really bad job. And it makes you think about these effective altruists and these idealists that maybe they're just... Are they just not that smart? I don't know. I'm just putting that out there, and I don't mean to malign anyone.
I think that's exactly right. None of it has been thought through very much. All they can do is a bunch of fucking thought experiments and trolley problems. And there's really no evidence that effective altruism has had any positive effects on the planet, you know, beyond the charitable arm of it. Right. So if you look at GiveWell or GiveDirectly or like those kind of places where they're like, what we want to do is save human lives today, then like quantifying that, I think there is a case to be made that has actually worked pretty well. But the minute they start saying, well, is saving human lives today really important compared to possibly saving the planet from the threat of an AI apocalypse? At that point, everything just becomes, you know, sort of dorm room masturbation.
Right. And then the one logical step from that is they don't know what they're talking about, perhaps, when they're talking about the AI apocalypse. Like, their dorm room imaginings extend to the AI apocalypse. They're just like, I watched Terminator and I think this is the big danger facing us. But now you have to think, like, these guys don't know what they're saying. Like, maybe the AI apocalypse isn't so bad.
It is almost impossible to overstate, Emily, the degree to which long-termist AI is influenced by science fiction and really, really cares about science fiction and treats various science fiction texts as being like incredibly important. And they're like, science fiction is one of the key ways in which effective altruists work through their ideas about what might happen in the future.
No, that just, I mean, that's dumb. Come on, isn't it? Oh my God. It's just like there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of real world problems that tech brings about. Like, we are living through it. The social media, the last big tech breakthrough, broke a lot of things. Politically, there are bad things that could happen, I'm sure, from AI, but like, not the things they're worried about. It's just so crazy. Like, just focus on reality. There are plenty of problems if you're so idealistic that you could be solving. It's just, it's embarrassing. I'm embarrassed for all these people.
I do want to talk about a different part of technology governance, though, Binance, after this.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
So an actually successful, actually profitable, mega global technology company, Binance, just lost its founder and CEO, CZ, because he pleaded guilty to various civil and criminal charges in federal court. And this is a big deal. Like, OpenAI, you know, is a money losing company. Binance is one of the most profitable technology companies in the world. It is the winner of the FTX implosion. FTX was basically created to be a competitor to Binance, never became as big as Binance, but it started threatening Binance before it collapsed. When FTX collapsed, Binance was the last major global crypto exchange standing, and it still is. And this is the thing that really fascinates me, is that as part of this kind of deal that Binance did with the US government, CZ, the founder, has stepped down. He's pleaded guilty to certain things. He stepped foot in the United States. He walked into federal court in Seattle to plead guilty. He knew that there was a risk that he would get arrested, but like, evidently he had some kind of promises that that wouldn't happen. And Binance itself continues. It's going to pay a $4 billion fine, and it's going to continue under new management. And I've seen various, you know, stories in the FT and places about, like, oh, you know, can Binance survive this? And I'm like, well, there has to, you know, by definition, there is always going to be a biggest crypto exchange in the world. And it is really hard for me to see what that exchange would be if it's not Binance. And you can really come down like a ton of bricks on this company and on its founder CEO. And he might even go to prison, although somehow I doubt it. And ultimately, like, this is a strong company because it is still going strong. It lost, like, you know, a few billion dollars of customer funds or whatever, but that's fine. There's nowhere for those customer funds to go.
Can we just say why Binance was charged? I think historically large fines by the U.S. government was because criminals were using the exchange to launder money, not just any criminals, but like Hamas was using it to launder money, other criminals. I mean, some of the quotes, there's this one I really liked. One guy inside the company said, quote, "We need a banner that says, is washing drug money too hard these days? Come to Binance. We got cake for you." Like, it was so blatant that they were doing this. So I feel like I don't want to lose sight of that. I just feel like it needs to be said.
Yeah. So it does rhyme a little bit with BitMEX, which was a previous exchange that got done for violating, you know, AML, KYC, money laundering, all of this kind of stuff.
Know your customer.
No one is actually accusing Binance itself of being a fraud, a la FTX. No one is accusing Binance itself of stealing anyone's money. What they are saying, which is absolutely true, is that Binance kind of turned a blind eye to certain activities that the U.S. would much rather didn't happen, right?
Not only turned a blind eye, their eyes were open and they were waving their hands. Come here, criminals.
They also acknowledged that they had given some of these people VIP status internally because they were moving so much money through the system, and they knew what they were doing, I guess.
That's an important point. It wasn't that they were doing a great job as a crypto exchange. They just were doing that great job for people that the United States government doesn't want them doing a great job for. It's still like, this is a good crypto exchange, right? I mean, it's the charges and the fine doesn't indicate that this is a place you don't want to exchange money, I guess, unless you're a big terrorist or something.
No, exactly. They are a good crypto exchange, and they are a good crypto exchange for the vast majority of their clients who are not terrorists, and also for the minority of their clients who are terrorists. And they were far too nice to the terrorists, and that is going to get you into trouble with the Americans. And this is a prime example, though, of the way in which the United States basically can take anyone on the planet and say, if you fund the kind of organizations who we don't like, even if you're not an American company and you don't have an American CEO and there's nothing, and you don't even use dollars because, you know, it's all crypto, we will find a way to come after you. And they did. And they, you know, and they managed to get this $4 billion fine. And I 100% believe that, like, a huge part of the whole impetus behind crypto in the first place, and all of the original true believers behind crypto, were basically saying the American fiat dollar system has way too much power, and we need to create a new, different parallel system that isn't within the reach of the American government. And it turns out that was impossible, and that ultimately, even though it wasn't dollar based, it was all crypto based, and, you know, they weren't in the United States, and they were quite careful to try and prevent American users from using Binance. Like, with all of those attempts to try and create a parallel non-American money exchange, international money exchange, the Americans are like, yeah, no, we don't like that. You're funding terrorists. We're going to fine you and not quite shut you down, but really cause a lot of damage. And it does show the power of the Americans. The fact that CZ came to America, turned himself in voluntarily, it's kind of amazing, because he was like, well, I could become, you know, an international fugitive for the rest of my life and try and avoid extradition and whatnot, you know, live in my penthouse in the Emirates somewhere and basically just know that I'm stuck and can never, there's like much of the planet I'm never going to be able to visit. Or I can just sort of write a $4 billion check and hope that I get no jail sentence, or at best a very short one. And he made that like calculated decision, partly because the overwhelming majority of his net worth is in Binance. And what this does is it allows him to continue to be the majority shareholder of Binance, which is worth a huge amount of money.
Do you think this does anything for confidence in the sector? Or is it just kind of nets out? This is sort of what people expect from crypto at this point, because it's still an early industry.
Well, I think what it shows is that the early dream in the crypto universe of being able to build something parallel to and separate from the US dollar system is dead. And that if there's ever going to be any kind of life in crypto going forwards, it's going to have to be compliant with a huge, you know, long list of US rules and regulations and whims. And at that point, like, kind of what's the point? Because you may as well just use dollars at that point.
Well, people are making money. Bitcoin, you know, the price of Bitcoin went up on this news, I believe, this week. So
yeah, you can trade Bitcoin. It becomes like a dumb casino, right? You know, like, this coin go up, that coin go down. It's like, but it loses any real dream of deep utility. Like, the reason why Bitcoin is better than the dollar has disappeared. It's no longer, it doesn't have any of those advantages anymore.
Right. This was just a showing of massive United States power at the end of the day. And the United States controls the world.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget. giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, so let's just return to Javier Milei. We did cover him in a previous episode when he won the primary. He is now, by a large margin, become the president-elect of Argentina. He is starting off on a glorious foot. Like, he immediately put out a press release saying that he'd talked to British Chancellor James Cameron, who had congratulated him on his election, which is glorious because, number one, the British Chancellor, like, he meant David Cameron, not James Cameron. Like, James Cameron is the film director. David Cameron is the guy who just came back as Foreign Secretary. But he came back as Foreign Secretary, not as Chancellor, which is, you know, anyway. I kind of think he thinks that the guy who directed Titanic is the Prime Minister of Britain.
Wouldn't that be great if true?
He seems to not really understand things about government functions generally. There's this great video where he's got, you know, a magnetized board and audit or magnets with lists of government agencies, and he's just ripping them off and saying, this one's got to go, this one's got to go, like a cat, you know, swiping things off a table.
Okay, but like, it's not like Argentina is this well-governed, amazing country in a great spot, and this guy's going to ruin it.
It's not going to make it. Dismantling the government entirely is not.
It's not going to happen. Like, let's just be very clear about this, because I said this last time we talked about him, and I think there are two big misconceptions about Javier Milei. The first one is that he is related to someone like Donald Trump or Geert Wilders, who just won, or didn't win, but did surprisingly well in the Netherlands election, or Javier Bolsonaro, or, you know, any of these kind of far right populists. And he has like hairstyle similarities with them, but in terms of ideology, you know, he's ideologically very, very different. He's not a nationalist. He's not a racist. He's not like, you know, he's not trying to stir up those kind of atavistic hordes that you see the far right try and pander to in the rest of the world. He really is an anarcho-capitalist, a self-described anarcho-capitalist in the tradition of various like Austrian economists, and he, you know, loves to talk about Murray Rothbard and Robert Lucas and people like this. And he honestly just believes that the best thing he can do for Argentina is to get rid of the government, make the government almost non-existently small, get rid of the currency, just have Argentines use the dollar, which they kind of already do in many cases, and just get out of the way and let the market solve all of the problems.
And that's anarcho-capitalism, Felix, just to make sure that everyone, including me, understand. It's basically let the market rule everything. That's it. That's what it means, anarcho-capitalist.
If, like, privatize, you know, Aerolíneas Argentinas and give all of the shares to its employees, and if they can't make it profitable, then let it die. You know, that kind of thing.
And that's more, that's not like the same as a free market capitalist. It's like a more extreme version of that, right?
It's imagine a free market, but without the government setting any kind of rules or guidelines. Imagine a free market without like FTC or any kind of antitrust, or, you know, like, it's just really very, very
like real free, super
anarchic.
Free.
Yeah.
Your companies are allowed to poison you because there's no FDA.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's like ideologically where he is, which is very like, you know, when people see the words far right wins election, I think they think a different type of far right. But then the second thing that people that is deeply misunderstood is that, like most countries, you know, the president of Argentina doesn't really have the power to do any of these things. If he wants to pass laws, he needs to get them through parliament. And the Peronists control parliament, and the Peronists have no love for Milei. And the Peronists really control politics in Argentina, even though they didn't win this election. And my base case outlook here is very much that the Peronists are just going to make his life a living hell and going to make it impossible for him to achieve anything. And he's going to be out within a couple of years because he's going to be incapable of doing anything. And he's talked about, like, I don't need parliament. I can just do referendums. It's like, yeah, good luck with that. There are various things he can do in terms of, like, you know, trying to stage some kind of a military coup or dissolving Congress or something like that, which would be illegal. But I don't think he has the capability to do any of them. And I think that taking his promises at face value and saying, like, oh, this is terrible because he says he's going to do this and this and this, kind of misses the fact that he's not going to be able to deliver on most of those promises, but he is going to be able to deliver on basically implementing the kind of austerity that, I hate to say it, Argentina kind of needs, because that's the only way you can get inflation down from its current, like, triple digit levels to something sensible.
Do you think he understands that he's not going to be able to do most of this stuff? Is he like Trump, where Trump gets up and says, I'm going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it, and he knows and everybody knows that that's bullshit? Or is it more he is sort of giving people a directional sense of what he wants to do?
He's a few arrows short of a quiver. You know, like, I don't know how realistic he is. Like, when he's coming out and he's winning elections with 56% of the vote or whatever, like, he does feel like he has a mandate and he does actually want to do a lot of this, and he's gung-ho full speed ahead, but he hasn't even been sworn in yet. And I think that pretty rapidly, once he actually becomes president and realizes that he can't just wave his hand and make stuff happen, he's going to be like, oh.
I like how he puts his picture on the dollar, and that's like a big thing for him, and people give him, you know, big oversized dollars with his picture on it, and I feel like that's fun. Like, we should all be doing that in our lives. Like, you put your own picture on a dollar and blow it up and use it as a calling card or wall art in your life, and I don't know, I feel like he's onto something there at least.
Yeah, the problem with our currency is that it's just very boring. We need a new aesthetic.
You need to, like, personalize it. I mean, it's 2023, right? It's our images are everywhere and everything. So we should have our own personalized dollars.
Maybe crypto can do that, Emily.
Yes.
This is not the numbers round, but I'm gonna come out with a quick number here, which is that if you look at the amount of cash, like physical US dollars, that are in circulation in Argentina, ignore all of the pesos and just look at the US dollars, it comes to about 4,400 US dollars per person. Mm-hmm. If you look at how much cash is in circulation in the United States, it's $3,100 per person. There is more American money, physical cash, circulating in Argentina per person than there is in the United States. And there is more American money in general in Argentina than in any other country in the world, except for the United States, right? So to a large degree, Argentina has already become dollarized. If you want to buy a car, if you want to buy a house, if you want to buy anything like actually valuable that keeps its value, you know, there's a very good chance you're going to be doing that with like stacks of $100 bills, because the peso, you know, no one trusts it.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder to people who complain about inflation in the United States. Argentina is really dealing with an inflation problem in a way we have no experience or understanding of, where literally your money vanishes in your hand. So you have to like put your US dollars, you know, under the floorboards or something because your pesos are just declining in value like by the second. It's a whole different ballgame. It's not just eggs are more expensive or whatever it is. They're not anymore, by the way.
Yeah, eggs are down. Did you see that the
eggs are down.
Thanksgiving dinner index, like the cost of a Thanksgiving dinner, it went down this year. Yep. Inflation is negative.
Yeah, the turkeys, because last year was really bad for the turkeys, as you know, I'm sure.
Was there like a bird flu thing going on?
The bird flu, they had to kill a bunch of turkeys. It was awful. But this year, turkeys are good. All good.
Yay. Okay, let's have a numbers round. You know what? I have a number literally in my hand right now, so I am going to start. My number is 4 million, which is the number of dollars that LNG carrier paid to jump the queue at the Panama Canal. Basically, there's a whole bunch of ships wanting to go through the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal doesn't have a lot of throughput right now because it's the water levels, although I don't quite understand. But in any case, this ship with a bunch of liquefied natural gas on it needed to get through the canal. And while it was waiting, it was sitting in the sun off the coast of Panama, and that gas was just evaporating.
Oy.
And so in order to get to the front of the line, it paid $4 million just to avoid, you know, sitting there and seeing its cargo just evaporate into the air.
That's expensive. I'm glad that it's good that they let them pay. I mean, they could have not let
this
them
is
pay.
Capitalism to the rescue, man.
Is this going to become a new rich person status symbol where you can get your mega yacht to the beginning of the line?
Yeah. If you have a mega yacht, you can sail through the Panama Canal and you can jump the line, but it will cost you $4 million. Like, I don't think they care whether you're a LNG ship or a mega yacht. Elizabeth, you have a number?
$3.28, and that's the national average price of gas right now, which is down 20% since early September. And this is kind of to your earlier point, inflation is negative, but I don't think you would know that if you were just looking at public sentiment. You know, there are a lot of people who still think we're in a recession. They think that inflation is up categorically because prices are not falling, because corporations don't have any incentive to do that. And I saw right before Thanksgiving, there were a lot of people on Twitter, which I realized is not indicative of the whole country.
Get off Twitter, Elizabeth. It's not good for you.
I know.
Come of Twitter. This is my great Thanksgiving wish for Twitter is for Elizabeth Byers to finally leave it.
We should start a write-in campaign.
Exactly. But yeah, I think this is fascinating to me, this number, because one of the things we've said over and over on this show is that gas prices are the most salient price in the economy. They're the thing that you see in 2-foot-high letters whenever you drive down any major road in the country. And gas prices, more than anything else, at least when they're going up, tend to give you what people think is happening with inflation. And when gas prices are down this much, that price, more than any other, would, in my mind, I would expect that price to cause people to think that inflation is no longer a problem because we actually have deflation in gas prices. So, yeah, there is a disconnect there, but like, it's a weird disconnect because normally people are wrong about inflation because they think that gas is much more important than it is. But in this case, they're wrong about inflation because they're ignoring the price of gas.
Or, yeah, some people still compare it to the 20. I see comparisons sometimes to the 2020 gas prices when you remember in like late March and April 2020, no one was driving. The price of gas was like $2 or something, you know? So yeah, I'll see like, it's usually like a Trump kind of fan or something saying like, well, when Trump was president, we had $2 gas. And I'm like,
yeah, bring back the pandemic. That'll solve everything.
Dude, no.
Emily, what's your number?
I'm bringing up this number, even though I know Felix doesn't like it. So I deserve whatever happens. Whatever happens next, I've brought it on myself. But
I know,
I'm doing it for
this
you.
Number is.
I'm doing it for you, Slate Money listeners.
Is this a generational thing?
The number is 525,947. And yes, it's generational. That is the desired ideal salary of the millennials. $525,947 compared to Gen X, which I think we all three are. Our desired salary is apparently $130,000, which, if you know anything about math, you know is less than $500,000. And this is from a survey done by Harris Poll, commissioned by Empower. It's a financial services company of some sort. And they asked all kinds of questions like, how much money can buy you happiness? What net worth do you need to be happy? And the average answer was like 1.2 million. But the millennial salary answer kind of blew everyone away because it's so much higher than all the other generations. But I posit that's because it was a smallish survey, which Felix will say, N only equaled 2,000, and that's not enough people. I'm front running his comments, hoping he will say nothing. and also because I think millennials need more money probably for salary than other generations, because they're kind of like in the thick of things, right? They're like starting to raise kids. They just need more, right? That's why millennials want so much more money.
$500,000 a year more? Like, I feel like it's possible to raise kids on more than less than $500,000 a year.
Well, yeah, but don't forget the avocado toast also that millennials need.
Oh, well, yeah. Obviously, okay, like 300,000 of that is avocado toast. Yeah.
It is quite a high salary demand.
I do think it would be interesting for someone to try to replicate this, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe we should do this at Axios. We have a relationship with Harris, right? And we'll be like, hey, Harris, can you go out and just run the same poll again?
Yeah, we should.
And see what happens. That would be fascinating.
Also, Slate Money listeners, please write in and tell us your desired salary. We can't make that happen for you, but we would like to know.
We want to know if we're undershooting for ourselves. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we be making $1 million a year? I don't know.
I want to know if there are people like who out there whose ideal salary is lower than what they're making.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting. Like the OpenAI people, they're so idealistic, but they're making $800,000 a year. I mean, come on. Money, you know, rubber meets the road here. What's your ideal salary is lower than what you make, right? Obviously, of course.
Obviously. Okay, I think that's it for us this week. We are going to have a Slate Plus segment on Larry Summers because I think we have to. Many thanks to Jared Downing for producing. Many thanks to all of you guys for writing in on slatemoney@slate.com. And we'll be back on Monday with actually a fantastic episode where I talk to Craig Mod about walking in Japan. I can recommend that one. It's lots of fun. See you then.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.